And good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI-FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org. We're on iTunes at College Radio, too. Today is Wednesday, November 20th, 2013. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and today our guests are Jody Pico and Danny Shapiro. I'll be here with Jody for the first half, and my guest host, Marie Stone, will be on with Danny for the second half. Jody Pico is the best-selling author of 21 novels published since 1992, beginning with Songs of the Humpback Whale. In 2012, she published a YA novel, Between the Lines, co-written with her daughter, Samantha Van Leer. Her last seven novels, including The Storyteller, which we'll be talking about today, have debuted at number one on the New York Times bestseller list. Her books have been translated into 34 languages and 35 countries. Four novels, The Pact, Plain Truth, The Tenth Circle, and Salem Falls, have been made into television movies. She's also written five issues of the Wonder Woman comic book series for DC Comics. She studied creative writing with Mary Morris at Princeton. And realism and a profound desire to be able to pay the rent led Jody to a series of different jobs following her graduation as a technical writer for a Wall Street brokerage firm, as a copywriter in an ad agency, as an eighth grade English teacher, before entering Harvard to pursue a master's in education. She married Tim Van Leer, whom she had known at Princeton, and while she was pregnant with her first child, she wrote her first novel, Songs of the Humpback Whale. She's won many, many awards and received an honorary Doctor of Letters degree from Dartmouth in 2010 and another from the University of New Haven in 2012. Hey, Jody.
How you doing?
Hi, good to talk to you again. It's been a long time.
It's been a long time.
Listen, before we get into my questions, I'd love to hear you talk about The Storyteller and how the book came about.
Sure. For me, the book actually came about from another book, which was The Sunflower by Simon Wiesenthal. And in it, Wiesenthal talks about an experience he had as a concentration camp survivor when he was in a concentration camp, and he was called to the bedside of a dying Nazi soldier who wanted to atone for what he had done. And he needed a Jew, any Jew would do, to spill his guts to, basically. And in the telling of this story, Wiesenthal ultimately decides that it is not up to him to forgive this man, that the only people who can are the ones upon whom the crimes have been perpetrated, and they're all dead. So basically, this Nazi's out of luck. And in the years since it's been published, there have been many republications, and they include these epilogues that are sort of written by many different types of people, politicians and religious leaders and theologians, and people who all weigh in on whether Wiesenthal did the right thing, what they would do, what forgiveness means. And it got me thinking, you know, what if I could update that story for a new generation, perhaps a generation that doesn't believe the Holocaust is very important because it was 70 years ago. I really wanted to see if I could sort of take that issue that Wiesenthal began with and bring it to the modern day. And at the same time, I was also thinking about the nature of good and evil and whether you can consider yourself to be a good person, and yet if there's one thing that might make you tip the balance and do something that the rest of us would consider particularly heinous, or by the same token, if you've done something really, really bad, is there any way to erase that stain from your life by doing good for many, many years afterward? And I began to develop this story about a young woman who is a baker in New Hampshire and is has a scar on her face and is very much a recluse and has sort of distanced herself from her family heritage, which is Jewish. She considers herself an atheist. And she befriends an old man who comes into the bakery who eventually tells her that he has something he wants to share with her. He has a secret. And this secret is that he was a Nazi officer. And she has to decide what she's going to do with that information. And that's really the premise of The Storyteller.
So are you also thinking themes when you wrote this book or any of your novels, or is that something that you figure out later or let your readers come to?
I think it's a little bit of both. I certainly was thinking about forgiveness and the nature of forgiveness and really how good and evil are often flip sides of the same coin. I would argue that any reader who picks up the book will probably come to those same themes themselves, but I'm sure there are others that they'll find unraveling across the book as well. There's a lot to be said here about the importance of history and whether it repeats itself. There's certainly a great deal about the power of the written word and the story, and who is a storyteller and why do we become storytellers? All of those things were themes that really evolved as I was writing the book.
What about the points of view? Because I think you have at least four points of view in this novel. Is that something you figured out before you started writing as well, or did when you felt that you really needed to tell another side of the story, did you bring in another character to tell it?
I knew that I wanted to tell the story in multiple points of view. I like doing it. I've written many books that way. It really keeps me on my toes as an author because my job is to make a page differentiate itself from another narrator's page. If you pick up my book and you open it anywhere, you should be able to tell whether it's Sage speaking or Leo or Minka or any of the characters because they do have a different ebb and flow to their voices. But that said, one of the nice things about having multiple narratives and multiple points of view is that the story is given piecemeal to the reader, and it's up to the reader to sort of sew them all together and to create something whole from all of these tiny patches. I actually really enjoy writing books that way. I just think it's fun to slip on someone else's voice for a little while. And certainly there are some that are more fun than others, and there are some that are very challenging. Minka's voice, Minka is Sage's grandmother, and she is a concentration camp survivor, was a really difficult one. It was draining, it was exhausting, and it was really hard for me to write because of the research that I had done with survivors and the urge that I had to make sure their stories were being honored. Leo, who is the man who works for the Department of Justice, who finds and prosecutes former Nazis who are hiding within the borders of the United States, is based on another man that I met who is actually a real-life fellow who does this in the Department of Justice down in Washington. And honestly, his voice was so easy to write because Eli Rosenbaum, the man who I interviewed, sounds just like Leo. He's funny, he's irreverent, he's just charming, and it was very easy to write his voice. And probably the most challenging one was to create Joseph's narrative. Joseph is this elderly gentleman who comes up to Sage and says, "I was a former Nazi," and yet everyone now knows him as this remarkable citizen of the town who has coached Little League and was a former German teacher and is beloved by everyone. He's everyone's favorite grandfather. It's hard to believe that he committed such atrocities. The reason that was so difficult was because although there's a lot of literature that has been written by survivors, it is not easy to find Nazis who are willing to sit down and chat with you, obviously. And to recreate what might make an ordinary German boy join the Nazi party and rise in its ranks was a real challenge for me.
You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI FM, and I'm with Jody Picope. We're talking about the storyteller. Speaking of Minka and the research, I'm guessing then that what I'm reading in the book, what happened to Minka, are true things, did happen.
Minka is a compilation of multiple survivors that I spoke with. Everything that happened to Minka, for the most part, happened to a survivor that I spoke to. There were plenty of other stories that did not make it into the book. But these were men and women who really opened up their history and their hearts to me, many times crying, spending hours telling me about their experiences in various factories and camps over the years. From Bernie, who came from a small town in Poland, and when he was being taken away by the Nazis, as a boy, he grabbed onto the side of his door frame and pried the mezuzah off the side of the door, and he kept it curled in the bottom three fingers of his hand for the entire war, to the point where his skin fused shut, and when he was a survivor after the war, he had to have surgery to have those fingers reopened, and he showed me the mezuzah that he'd carried all these years, which is an incredible story. Mm. You know, to Gerda Weissman Klein, who is the recipient of the Congressional Medal of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Gerda is someone who survived a 350-mile walk in the winter of 1945, you know, with 4,000 women who were marched in the horrible, desolate winter at the end of the war. Out of those 4,000, 150 survived. And she says the only reason she did is because when she left home in June, when the Nazis came for her family, her father said, "Gerda, wear your ski boots."
Mm.
Or Manya, who was actually my favorite survivor and is now like an extra grandma to me, who also grew up in Poland in a very Christian neighborhood, had tons of Christian friends, and went to a Catholic high school where she took German because she had to take either French or German, and French was taught by an old, ugly nun, and German was taught by a young, attractive male teacher. So she became his star pupil. And she was so fluent in German that it wound up saving her life multiple times during the war, as she was continually placed into secretarial positions because of her fluency in the language. You know, so all of those things began to combine into the character of Minka.
Mm. So, you know, I know this from knowing of your work over time and your process, and you do a lot of firsthand research. I mean, you go to places and you don't rely on the internet to do all that you need to do. Will you talk a little bit about that? Because I know, I mean, I know a lot of people are, a lot of writers, it's like the internet's there, let me just do it that way.
Well, you know, when I was starting out and I had no money and no resources, I didn't use the internet because it didn't exist, but I used libraries. And I did research with books, and I tried really hard to make phone calls when I could or find local experts who were willing to talk to me about what they did and how they did it. I've always found that speaking to a person who has lived the life of your character is a very good way to slide into your character's head. And ultimately, it's my job to write from the point of view of authority for that character. I need to know more about her than anyone else. I need to know what she eats for breakfast, even if it never winds up being printed in the book. And sometimes to do that, it's easiest for me to shadow a person who maybe has her job or has lived that experience or has a child who's ill or any of the other things that I'm writing about. Very often in proximity with these people who are truly living the experience, I wind up finding out things that I didn't even know I needed to know, which is why I like to do my research firsthand. I get asked all the time, "Oh, can I be your research assistant?" And I think, absolutely not. That's the most fun part of this. You know, I get to be someone else for a day. So it's an interesting process for me, and it's always a very expansive process. I very often feel like the reason no one could do my job for me is because a light goes off in my head when I hear someone say to me during a research interview something that I know I'm going to use in the book. And maybe until that second, I didn't even know I was going to use it. But I can't trust anyone to have my brain or to know how my brain works, which is one of the reasons I do it all myself. But like I said, it's really fun for me to go out and collect these stories and collect these histories from people and really hear their hopes and their fears and the patterns of their voice, so that I can create a character who hopefully is just as real as they are.
Mm. I'd love to hear you read.
Sure.
Okay.
So the section that I'm going to be reading from is Minka's section, which is smack in the middle of the story, and it is a flashback, an extended flashback about Minka's time as a Jew during Nazi occupation and all the different workshops and camps that she's been in. And the section that I'm going to be reading to you from, she is a teenager. She is a writer. She has been working very hard on a novel for years with her best friend Daria, who has already been taken from the ghetto where they're living. She has recently been taken from this ghetto with her father to Auschwitz. And the only other thing that you need to know is that, like Manya, my friend, she is fluent in German. Okay. So this is Minka. If you had to pack your whole life into a suitcase, not just the practical things like clothing, but the memories of the people you had lost and the girl you had once been, what would you take? The last photograph you had of your mother? A birthday gift from your best friend? A bookmark embroidered by her? A ticket stub from the traveling circus that had come through town 2 years ago, where you and your father held your breath as jeweled ladies flew through the air and a brave man stuck his head in the mouth of a lion. Would you take them to make wherever you were going feel like home, or because you needed to remember where you had come from? The ramp where we disembarked was a sea of humanity. We were numb, stiff, suffocating from the heat, gasping for fresh air. Several men in striped clothing were trying to sort us. My father began to move to the left with the other men. "Papa!" I screamed, running toward him. I was pushed and shuffled and yanked forward until I stood in front of one of the guards. He was standing beside a man in a white coat who was the one directing us. The soldier was tall and blonde. He was holding a pistol. I looked away, trying to find my father in the moving mass of people. The man in the white coat grasped my chin in his hand, and it was all I could do not to spit at him. He gestured to the left. I was euphoric. I was headed in the same direction as my father, which meant we surely would be reunited. "Danke," I murmured, out of habit. But the soldier, the blonde one, had heard what I said under my breath. "Sprichst du Deutsch?" "I am fluent," I stammered. The soldier leaned toward the man in the white coat and murmured something. White coat shrugged. "Brecht," he pronounced. My father had been sent to the left, and now I was being sent to the right because I had been stupid enough to speak German. I've thought about it many times, you know, about what would have happened if I'd gone to the left, which every muscle in my body was pulling me toward. But nobody likes a story without a happy ending, and I knew I had to do whatever they said if I were to have any chance of seeing my father again. As I passed the soldier who had spoken to me, I realized his right hand, the one holding the pistol, was twitching. I was afraid he'd shoot me by accident, if not on purpose. We were herded into the building and told to undress, everything off, clothes, shoes, stockings, underwear, hairpins. I looked around, embarrassed. We were moved to a table where Jewish women in striped clothing held electric razors. "Please," I said, "don't cut off my hair." "Maybe you have something to persuade me to give you just a trim. You look like the kind of person who would smuggle something through." This woman had presumably once been in line like us. If these Germans wanted to turn us into animals, then they had succeeded. "Even if I did," I whispered back, "you would be the last person on earth I'd ever give it to." She looked at me, raised her razor, and buzzed my hair off at the scalp. It was at that moment I realized I wasn't Minka anymore. I was some other creature, something inhuman. Shivering, sobbing, I followed orders and hurried blindly into the shower room. I closed my eyes and tried to picture all the people I had loved in my short life. My parents, my sister, my best friend Daria. I wanted to die with their names on my tongue. I felt a trickle. Water. "Raus!" a guard yelled. Dripping, I shuffled quickly out of the shower room and was given clothing. I was still buttoning my jacket when a guard grabbed me. I didn't understand what he was doing at first. It burned, and I could smell the sear of flesh. I looked down. A14660, I had been branded like cattle. Before I realized what I was doing, my feet were flying across the dirt as best I could in my wooden shoes toward the electric fence. I knew, if I got close enough, that I would be free, that Daria, and please God, my father, would remember me as Minka, not as this bald animal, not as a number. My arm stretched outward, as if I were racing toward a lover. A woman's voice started to yell. I could hear the angry shouts of a guard who a moment later collided with me. He dragged me upright by the collar of my dress and threw me into the barracks. I pushed myself to my knees, only to find someone reaching out a hand to me. "What were you thinking?" a girl said. "You would have died, Minka." I squinted. One moment, I could not see past the shorn head and the bruises on her face. And then the next, I recognized Daria. Just like that, I became human again.
Thank you so much. That was Jodi Picco reading from The Storyteller, published by Atria. You know, I love this book, and I love the layers to it. And I'm curious because, you know, there's a whole story. There's Sage's personal story, her relationships, what she's dealing with, and there's so much going on here. How much did you know going in? I mean, I'm wondering if one of your secrets, which may not even be a secret, to being so prolific is that you know enough about your work when you begin that you don't get hung up in, you know, page 10 going, what happens now?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people ask me how I map out my stories and if I know where everything's going, and I usually know the beginning and I know the end. And I also know the structure, which for a book like this is critically important. I didn't want to keep ripping it apart and figuring out, well, who's going to speak now? And am I going to stick this flashback in the middle? Or how's that going to work out? I needed to know that before I actually began writing it. So that was settled in my mind before I began. And then it's just a matter of developing the voices and hearing their stories. You know, I think that I don't plot as detailed an outline as other authors that I know, but this works for me, you know, which I think is the great mystery to writing. It's great to do research and find out what other writers do, but ultimately what you really need to know is what works for you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, being able to have a general framework, a skeleton around which I can build the whole animal is very helpful to me.
Mm. And you also definitely have this great sense of drama and you know, when I think when you write literary fiction, we talk about this a lot. It's difficult to necessarily make things happen. And in your books, there's always something happening.
Yeah. That's, you know, I mean, I would argue I write commercial fiction, and you and I can have a whole 3-hour talk about the difference between commercial and literary fiction and why that's totally arbitrary in my mind. But, you know, I think that I remember one of the first things I was taught, actually, by Mary Morris, who used to teach at UC Irvine, when she was my professor at Princeton, was, you know, enter the scene as late as you can and get out as early as you can.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a great way to feel the tension the minute you start with a character and to also leave the reader hanging when you walk out. And I think I still adhere to that rule. You try really hard to make it hard for a reader to put that book down. You want them to be going, oh, well, just one more chapter. I can stay up just a little later. That's my goal when I'm writing.
Mm. Thank you so much for coming back on the show, Jody. It's been a pleasure, and like I said, I just love this book. And
I really appreciate it.
Thank you. That was Jody Pico. Her book is The Storyteller, and yeah. Loved it, and had to have her on to talk about it, and I'm so glad she could come on. So stay with us. Marie Stone will be here next with Danny Shapiro. Don't go anywhere.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
KUCI.
It makes me wanna. KUCI.
It makes me wanna.
KUCI.
KUCI.
It makes me wanna. KUCI. It makes me wanna.
KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes under College Radio, or you can go to Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com, for information on direct downloads, past shows, upcoming shows. We've got information on her speaker series event. Lots of information up there, but you can always find us there. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone, and I'm joined by Danny Shapiro. Danny is the best-selling author of the memoirs Devotion and Slow Motion and five novels, including Black and White and Family History. Her work has appeared in The New Yorker, Granta, Tin House, One Story, Elle, it goes on and on, the LA Times, and has been widely anthologized. She has taught writing programs at Columbia, NYU, The New School, and Wesleyan. She is the co-founder of Cyrilland Writers Conference in Positano, Italy. She's a contributing editor at Travel and Leisure. She lives with her family in Litchfield County, Connecticut. Her new book, Still Writing, The Perils and Pleasures of a Creative Life, was published last month and is the subject of our chat this morning. Danny, welcome.
Thanks, Marie. Good to be here.
Thanks for coming on. So let's start out with, I'll let you introduce the book and talk a little bit about it and why another writing book. I always love to ask writers of writing books what inspired a writing book.
Right. No, that's a great question because I asked myself that question a lot when I was embarking on it. I mean, the way it began was actually as a blog, which was a completely shocking thing to me, first of all, that I had a blog, and second of all, that I ended up writing a book out of it. But what happened was my publisher, I guess about 5 years ago, really urged me to start blogging, and, you know, lots of writers feel like we need to have some kind of presence on the Internet, and I just kept on thinking, well, what am I going to blog about that's going to make me not want to stick pins in my eyes? And
right.
It really did. It was like, who cares what I had for breakfast, and what can I write about that will be a deep well that I can keep on dipping into? And my subject was writing and not craft, though craft certainly would, you know, make an appearance in the blog, but really about what it takes to sit down every day in solitude and do this work of grappling with the page, of, you know, facing the blank page on a daily basis, and what it takes and what the pitfalls are and what the pleasures are. And so I started blogging, and then a funny thing started to happen, which is that just about every day I would get emails from other writers, and they were from beginning writers and seasoned writers and friends of mine and people I admired, and they all seemed to contain the exact same sentence, almost like eerily so, and the sentence was, thanks, this is what I needed today. I needed this today. And I hadn't realized I was doing anything that anybody needed. I was just trying to kind of put some thoughts out there on a like weekly, bi-weekly basis. And then eventually the questions morphed into, when's the book coming out? And I wasn't writing a book. no intention of it, not anywhere in the back of my mind. But at some point I just started realizing that people were kind of asking for it. And then I went back and I looked at, because, yeah, there are a million writing books out there, and a few of them have meant a great deal to me. And I thought, well, what do I have to contribute that hasn't, you know, or do I have anything to contribute that hasn't been contributed before? And I went back and I reread the books that mattered to me the most, and also some others, and I realized that what I wanted to do was more of a kind of a hybrid between memoir and a book about the writing life, that it wasn't so much about craft. There are a lot of books about craft, and craft interests me as a toolbox, but, you know, doesn't interest me so much as reading about it or writing about it. but thinking about, well, what formed me as a writer and what forms us as writers? And that interests me endlessly. And so the book ended up being structured as, you know, part my own, you know, my own journey of what was formative, and partly I wanted it to be a companion for other writers. It's all so solitary, and it can be, it can be lonely, and it can be lonely, but it can actually just feel like we're out of step, mm-hmm. you know, like we're just out of step with the rest of humanity. I feel that way all the time, and I reach for the wisdom of other writers to make me feel less alone, and that's what I wanted Still Writing to be.
Yeah, it did really strike me as very memoirish, and it was somebody observed, and I thought this was really true, that you have the ability to make writers or people in general feel like you really know their story. I think by being so personal and in touch with your own story, you make other people feel very known when they read you. And, what a gift that is. I was wondering if that... You know, if people come up to you, strangers come up to you where they feel like they know you because you've been so expressive and open with them. You were at a speaker series event about a month ago, and I was watching you with other people, and the people came up to you sort of as though, I know you. I know your story. I know everything about you. And what a surreal experience that must be for you, you know, to sort of take these people in, right?
Somebody just yesterday said something very much like that to me, you know, in that sort of, I feel like I know everything about you. And what's so interesting to me about writing memoir and creative nonfiction, and, you know, and I've written a lot that has been personal, and I've written a lot that's been imaginative, but based on the imagination. But the thing about writing memoir is the writer is crafting exactly what he or she wants the reader to know, or the writer is crafting a story out of a life. So it actually is an act of tremendous control and picking and choosing what goes in and what doesn't go in. So I think, you know, it's very much a misapprehension that that the writer is known, you know, in that way. Like every once in a while, you know, somebody will say, you must feel so exposed. I feel like, you know, I know everything about you. And I'll say, you know, you didn't read my diary. If you read my diary, I might have to kill you. But, this is a crafted piece of work. And in many ways, I think fiction writers are more exposed or are likely to have a greater sense of being seen on the page because so much of the process is subconscious.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But it's true. It's true that there is this feeling. I realized a few years ago that I moved with my family to the country and was making new friends for the first time since, you know, I don't know, college, you know, like a whole bunch of new friends in this community. And at a certain point, I realized I would go out for dinner with a new girlfriend or go out to lunch. And afterwards, I would realize that she hadn't asked me one single solitary thing about myself. And yet, she had completely overshared. Like, people right and left were telling me their most intimate secrets. And I kept on scratching my head and thinking, like, what is this about? And I finally realized that they had read my work, so they felt that they really knew me, and they were telling me their deepest, darkest secrets as a way of sort of leveling the playing field so that we could know each other.
Uh-huh.
And it was the strangest thing, and I imagine that a lot of other memoirists have a similar kind of experience where I feel like, you know, ask me about myself, you'll get a different story.
Right. That's a great insight. My guest this morning is Danny Shapiro, the book Still Writing, The Perils and Pleasures of a Creative Life. I guess to sort of dovetail on that, you also talked about catchphrases that you use when you're talking about something deeply and intensely personal, like your mother's passing or your mother's car accident, and she had, you know, 80 broken bones, and you use these. Everybody does this, use these kind of simplistic, cursory details to substitute for the emotion of the experience itself. And that should be a clue to the writer that they're not going deep enough, that they're glossing over something.
Yeah, that was a real insight that I had, actually, as I was working on Still Writing. I was having a long talk with my husband, who's also a writer and who's my first reader, And he pointed out to me, in particular, there were two places that there were almost these kinds of, like, written tics, and, you know, they can also be verbal tics that, you know, a lot of people have, I think, when we want to just dispatch with something. We don't want to feel it. Somebody asks us a question, like, are your parents still living? You know, or, you know, just a question where the answer might be painful if you're really to stop and start thinking about, well, no, my father died in a car accident, and my mother was very badly injured in that accident. She had 80 broken bones. And I realized whenever I would talk about it, and then also when I would write about it, I sort of moved into this, you know, this shorthand of glossing over it, sort of skidding over the surface of it, and therefore not having to feel it. And, you know, that's fine in casual conversation where we want to be maybe a little bit self-protective, but it's really not fine on the page where every time, you know, we go to a place like that, we have to sort of, you know, dig into it anew. Otherwise, why go there?
Right.
And so I found myself really going back to those places where I might have just wanted to kind of, like, get through it. Here's the information, reader.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
right.
I needed to find new language to articulate, you know, the deeper feeling and not just, you know, conveying the information.
I guess that raises the question, because you've written about your parents' accident several times and your son's illness as an infant several times. And each pass that you take through those life events with your own age and experience, the hindsight of writing about it in the past versus the way you would write about it now, have you found that the way you approach topics in your own life has changed, that the way you would write about it today is very different than the way you would have written about it 10 years ago?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, and that sort of has led me to another insight, which is that when it comes to this kind of, you know, memoiristic writing, that the relationship between the self and the story, you know, the self in time and the story, is a big part of the story. I mean, if we think about what memory is, it's not fact. It's mutable. It's changeable. It's something that is like, you know, bobs on the waters of consciousness. It's always shifting and changing. And so my first memoir, Slow Motion, I wrote when I was in my early 30s, and it was about events that took place in my early 20s. So I was 10 years away from those events, which at that time was enough distance to be able to see my younger self with a pretty cold eye and a kind of an ironic eye, and be able to sort of see myself as having evolved from that place, but at the same time not so far away that it wasn't still a little bit raw for me and immediate.
Mm-hmm.
If I were to write Slow Motion today, in midlife, it would be a very different book. The voice would be different. The memories would be different. There was a moment when I was writing my last memoir, Devotion, where I realized I was covering a scene that was the same ground as I had written about in Slow Motion. It was one piece of overlap in both books, and it was, in fact, the morning of my father's death. And I could have gone and looked at Slow Motion and seen what I had written, and instead I wrote the scene and I tried to you as closely to my memory of that day as I could. And it was a very cold winter day. The sky was blue. I was wearing a gold blouse and a black skirt. I had come to the hospital, and I had just gotten the news that my father had died. And as I wrote it, my half-sister came in, and she said, "Where's Dad?" And we were raised in an Orthodox Jewish home where you don't leave the body unattended, and I didn't know that. And so I said, he's still upstairs, his body is upstairs in the room. And she said, "How could you have done that? How could you have left the body unattended?" And the feeling was that I had failed my father terribly, and that I had, you know, a dreadful, dreadful feeling. So I finished the scene, and I polished it, and then I went back and looked at what I had written in Slow Motion more than 10 years earlier. And it was the exact same scene, the same weather, the same outfit, the same dialogue, except that it was my uncle who came into the hospital and said, "Where's your father?"
Mm.
And it was kind of an incredible moment because I thought, well, what's true?
Right.
You know, what is the fact? I don't know. Is my memory truer because it's further away, truer because it would have been closer? And I let them stand. I never even considered not letting them stand because, to me, that was a really powerful document about the nature of memory and story. I mean, the emotional content wasn't different. The scene itself wasn't different, but those words came out of two different people's mouths. And that's, I think, the way in which, it's a powerful and small example of the way in which I think our memory can really shift and change over time. I've always thought it would be a really cool thing to have for one writer to spend their entire life to make it their ove to write the same memoir every 10 years.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because it's more true about your relationship with those two people, probably, than whatever the fact is. It doesn't matter what the fact is, but
right,
but
exactly.
It's revealing of your emotion towards your sister versus your uncle. Very
exactly.
Very interesting, yeah. The other thing you said was watching for word repetition as another substitute for emotion. You know, if you use, I think you use the word muffled or something, but
yeah.
Just being aware, the writer being aware of overusing a particular word as that being a signal. I just thought it was kind of lazy writing, but I like your insight that it's actually a signal that you're avoiding something or that you're glossing over some emotion and you're substituting this particular word. That's wonderful.
Yeah, exactly. There was a the word muffled. I had a very, very good copy editor for my novel Black and White, and right before the book was actually going into its final pass before it was going to be printed, she wrote to me and she said, I just had this feeling, and I did a word search on the word muffled, and the word muffled appears 11 times in your book. And thank goodness for her, because that would have been bad. I mean, you shouldn't have more than one muffled in a book. And but as I was going through it, what I realized was that the word muffled was really standing in for something else, for something in my character's internal life that was muffled,
mm-hmm.
Muffled to herself in a way, or inaccessible to herself, that I needed to get at, and I needed to find sort of a deeper truth about her in each one of those places. And, one of the tricky things is that I think that these ticks or these repetitions or these places of, repetitions happen. They change with every book. They change with every piece of work. I once had an editor call me up with an early novel of mine and say, what's with all the bathrobes? Like, all the characters are in bathrobes all the time. I don't know. Like, maybe I was in a bathrobe while I was writing it a lot. But, it keeps changing. Therefore, it's not something that a writer can learn once, like, oh, I overuse this word or this phrase or this rhythm, because with each piece of work and with the voice of each new piece of work, that changes too.
Right, right. So interesting. My guest this morning is Danny Shapiro, the book Still Writing, The Perils and Pleasures of a Creative Life. You talk a lot about in here your relation, and you've talked in general about your relationship with meditation and what a great role and metaphor meditation is for the creative writing life, that same stillness, that same deep awareness, that same, blocking out all of the voices in your head. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about your relationship with meditation as it relates to your writing, and if there are other parts of your life that also feed writing in similar ways.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's a great question. I mean, meditation is something that I've come to slowly over the years. I had a long time yoga practice before I began to even attempt to sit down and meditate, and I think it was in my memoir, in embarking on writing Devotion, which was really about a kind of spiritual existential crisis, that I just had this feeling of, needing, like a hunger for it, and at the same time being completely convinced that I would be a bad meditator, whatever that means, which, there's anyone who meditates would say there's no such thing. What it really is about watching the contents of your mind and just noticing what it is that's going through your mind, and then not so much blocking things out, but just noticing and then saying, okay, well, that's going on, okay, and then coming back to the breath. And that has such a relationship to writing for me, because to write is to know your own mind, is to learn, you know, the contents of your own mind, and to meditate is to learn, you know, what's going on in there, and to see without judgment, just to see. And I write at home, and I often during the course of the day go off the rails. I mean, multiple times. The internet, like, throws me off. The doorbell rings, it throws me off. You know, today my dog peed on the living room carpet. That completely threw me off. You know, I'm, like, on the internet looking up, you know, how to clean, you know, a sisal carpet. You know, it's things throw you off, and then you get all this noise in your head. And meditation and yoga are the one way that I know that to actually restart my day. If it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon and I've really just, you know, I've just kind of gotten in my own way over and over again. I mean, I will often talk about the way that the longest walk of my day every morning is from the cappuccino maker in my kitchen to my desk.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's probably like 50 steps, but it feels like I'm climbing Everest.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many ways to get distracted. And the discipline or the practice of just, if I sit down, if I unroll my mat and I sit down, even for 5 minutes, it will change the nature of my mind. And then that mind coming back to the page will have a little bit more room, will have a little bit more space and clarity. And, you know, today there are so many incredible ways to, to have that happen. It doesn't mean, you know, necessarily in this kind of all-or-nothing way, going off and sitting on a mountaintop or going on a silent retreat. I've done that, but it doesn't mean that. It can mean something as simple as sitting down for 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 5 minutes. There are all these apps now. There's something called Headspace. There's another one called, like, calm.com that you can have on your iPhone. I mean, it sounds counterintuitive.
It does.
But it's kind of great, because in this noisy, noisy world that we live in, to be able to just actually notice, oh, I haven't had a moment of silence today, or a moment of, just not thinking about what I have to do next and next and next in my 50,000 things on my to-do list. But the paradox is that by sitting still, it actually creates the room in which that doesn't seem as daunting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the one other piece of it is that when I'm writing, there, and I think this is true for all of us, there is a moment where I want to just jump up, right? I'll suddenly be hungry, you know, suddenly hungry, or suddenly really need to check that thing, check my email, or something needs doing. It's often a moment where, in which I should be doing the opposite of that. I should be sitting and staying right there because I'm about to make some sort of breakthrough. I'm about to pierce that piece of work and go to a different level. And it's hard and it's scary and it sort of feels like a surge of energy. And to avoid that surge of energy, one will just get up to kind of avoid it. And it is precisely that same mechanism in meditating. That feeling of, oh, you know, I better write that down. I'm going to forget it. Or I just need to get up now. I wonder how long it's been. Has it been 10 minutes yet? It's the same feeling. And so training the mind to actually just sit with that is enormously good for the writing process.
Right, right. The book is dedicated to Grace Paley, and you have a nice little section on her being a great mentor of yours. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about your relationship with her, what she meant to you, how the book came to be dedicated to her.
Mm. Yeah, it's in part Still Writing is dedicated to Grace because I think that she was, for me, a first role model. She was also an amazing teacher and the kind of teacher who... I had her at Sarah Lawrence, where I was both an undergraduate and where I got my MFA. And she was the kind of teacher who would say things that I might not understand at the time that, literally like 10, 15 years later, a light bulb would go off, and I would think, oh, that's what grace meant. Like she used to say, and I write this in Still Writing, she used to say that she wrote, she did a lot of her best work in the bathtub. And at the time, I really imagined Grace like lying neck deep in suds and like with a precariously balanced yellow legal pad somehow perched over her and writing in the bathtub. And years and years later, I thought, oh, she meant she took a bath. Like, she meant she just took a break. You know, that so many times our best ideas come to us when we've let our mind be quiet, you know, and just drift, and whether it's a bath or a drive or a walk or whatever it is. And so she was full of wisdom like that. And but she also was this person in the world, and she was a mother, and had a long time marriage, and she lived in the city in New York, and she came up to Sarah Lawrence to teach, and she always had room for her students. She loved her students, and you know, you'd always, you know, walk into Grace's office, and there was always, you know, some crying girl in the, you know, sitting on the floor, and, you know, like with her head in Grace's lap, you know, some heartbreak or some, you know, writer's block or anything. Really, she was just this kind of den mother, and she had room for it, and she didn't have an edge. She was kind, you know, at the same time, incredibly discerning. And she was a citizen of the world. Like, you would come to class sometimes, and there would be a note tacked to the door of the classroom saying, sorry, Grace is in jail, because she would have been arrested for civil disobedience. She had a sense of moral outrage and of an absolute need to be involved if her being involved could help her change things. And, you know, that for me, coming from a world, you know, the world that I grew up in where I didn't know any writers, and I didn't know you could be a writer, and I didn't know what being a writer could even possibly look like, she really lit the way for me and showed me that.
I love that. Oh, God, we're out of time. And we were going to talk about New Yorker cartoons and other things, and we're all out of time. Was there anything big that we should have covered that we didn't cover?
Oh, gosh.
Lots of things, I know. lots of big things.
No, I just think, you know, the wonderful thing for me about Still Writing is that what I'm hearing from people again and again now is precisely that feeling of that it's a companion for people, and it makes me so happy to think of it on writers' desks and on their nightstands, and just knowing that maybe I've done a little something to make, you know, to make part of my tribe feel less solitary.
Yeah, we should mention that your blog continues, and it's really wonderful. You write, it's really wonderful. It's
Thank
on your
you.
Website, yeah.
Yeah, which is www.dannyshapiro.com. It's D-A-N-I.
Exactly.
Shapiro.com.
Exactly. So the book kind of continues. I mean, it's got addendums on the blog, and I don't know how interactive your blog is. I know you take it sounds like you take
it's
emails.
It's pretty interactive. You know, I do that, and I'm on Facebook, and I'm on Twitter, and I engage with my readers and you know, all my writer friends. I enjoy that. I, you know, have to be careful about not having it take over my life, because, you know, when you're not writing, you're not a writer when you're not writing, really.
Yeah.
But it's all of a piece.
Danny Shapiro, this was a huge pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you. I so enjoyed it.
You too. That was Danny Shapiro. The book, Still Writing, The Perils and Pleasures of a Creative Life, is out and available now. Her blog is at DannyShapiro.com. Wonderful blog. And that's all the time we have for today. We'll be right back here with you next Wednesday morning, 9 a.m. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.